Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
The infrastructure thing, it's back in the news because we, as you will recall, after a long debate, I mean, we covered this ad infinitum for a while there, the urban boundary expansion, and we know what happened with that. The city said, no, we're not going to expand our urban boundaries. We're going to lock that down. City Council did that. Well, now there is a group of developers that is appealing the city's decision about this and has launched an appeal to the Ontario Land Tribunal. It wants to build several thousand homes east of Mount Hope in Glanbrook. Now, City Council, as I said, has already made a decision. The councillor of that area, Mark Tattison, Ward 11 councillor, he has said this is a non-starter. But what does this actually mean, and could this go anywhere? Does this do anything, or is this, when he says it's a non-starter, is it not even worth talking about? Let's bring in the Ward 11 councillor from Glanbrook, Mark Tattison. How are you tonight?
Hey, I'm good. How are you, Scott?
I appreciate you doing this. I'm very well, thank you. So here's the confusion I have, and maybe I think that a lot of other people are going to have, is clearly the option is open, the mechanism is open for these developers to go to the Ontario Land Tribunal. What happened, and we don't know what will happen here, but let's just play the hypothetical. What if they win? What does that actually mean?
Yeah, I don't see that happening at this point. I guess if they won, it would be back on the table and subject to a whole bunch of planning by the city. A whole bunch of infrastructure would have to occur. And even if that was the case, we're looking decades, like a decade at least down the road.
I guess part of that is who has the ultimate say here? Does the city have the absolute final say on what happens here, or could the land tribunal's decision trump the city's decision and override that? I'm just not sure who has the final vote.
Oh, I would think that it would be the OLT, because cities are, as far as I'm my understanding, and I'm just, like I said, a first-year councillor here, the OLT and the provincial government has jurisdiction over the cities and what they say goes, and usually when there's no OLT decision, the city lives with it.
So those things, though, usually, as I understand, as I've noticed over the years, those usually involve, that I've seen anyway, like a condo building or a development of something. We're not usually talking about something in the magnitude of nearly 5,000 homes. That's a massive, again, if this was to go through, that's a massive thing the city would have to deal with.
Yeah, well, Scott, I'm just jumping through hoops trying to get water and sewers down to a community rec center. This is a group of individuals trying to build an entire community inside our rural area. So I think it's a stretch for them. I don't see it going anywhere at this point. You know, when the Greenbelt lands to the south of Whitechurch were returned to the Greenbelt, it was rescinded for a reason. The process was flawed. And then when the urban expansion was rescinded as well, that legislation got pulled back for exactly the same reasons by the minister. The process was flawed. It was suspected undue influence and rushed. So I don't see how a tribunal could support any appeal on its merits that came as a result of such flawed legislation, much less an incomplete one as this. Like what they filed was totally incomplete. The other issue is that the landowners only own about 300 acres. What you need to do when you submit proposals, you have to have a unified group come forward. They have to collaborate, because, you know, the decisions have to be made on the entire 800 acres, like who's going to get the school, who gets the playground, who gets whatever you have, because there's different values assessed, stormwater management, all the infrastructure that has to go in. So there's different values assessed to it. And it has to be a collaborative effort by the developers. You can't just forward something if you own less than 50% of the land, I would think.
I recognize, Councillor, that I'm asking you some things that, you know, again, probably this is going to be a learning curve for you and for us and for everybody as well as this goes on. But
sure.
You mentioned the infrastructure. So one of the interesting parts about this is, let's say they were successful and they got the right to go ahead and do this. Is the city obligated to develop that land, to put in sewers and put in all that stuff, or could that expense fall on the developers where the city could just say, okay, fine, you won, but we're not building anything out there. So if you want to do it, it's all up to you.
Yeah, and that's a learning curve for me. I would say city can't afford to do it. We can't afford any more sprawl. To service those areas, it would just be a huge hit financially for the city. We can't do that. So I just know from what I see with the books, that's why it's a non-starter for me.
There are, right now, there's been a lot of talk about area rating, not very recently, but leading up to this year, this council, even in the election, a lot of talk about area rating. Again, if something happened, could the city say, yeah, okay, go ahead and build it, but your tax rate is going to be triple what everyone else is to pay for this development? Is that allowed? Is that legal?
You know what? I don't even want to go there, Scott. That's just going to get everyone worked up. I see this, honestly, I see this as a non-starter. I think what's happening here is, you know, when urban expansion, it's been paused. It's still simmering on the back burner. Like, you know, Minister Calandra said, like, hey, we're going to pause it. We're going to reintroduce a urban expansion process that's not flawed, that's transparent, that's going to be based on research. So what I'm thinking is perhaps these developers, if I was thinking like them, I'd want to get my land on the table to be considered. And one way of bringing it back to the forefront is through the OLT. And it's at the forefront of our news today, and we're talking about it. So I guess, like, you know, my play is thinking, what's their play? Maybe this is that Hail Mary pass, and maybe they're not going to win this game, but they're setting up for a game later down the road when the new process starts. So I'm just surmising that, but these are the, like, you know, when I try and put myself in their shoes, like, I thought this doesn't make sense. But if you look at it, well, what would be my next logical move be if I own this land and it's been put back in the rural, but I, you know, want it to be forwarded for development? So this is what I'm thinking. Maybe it's just a play on them by them to further their cause and like I said, keep it on the table.
One more thing, and that is, I don't know how this works politically. If you're the ward councilor, do they come and talk to you to feel things out, or does that not happen at the municipal level? Have they come to you and tried to convince you of the rightness of this move that you clearly have not bought?
Developers approach me on a continuing basis. I just want to say that everyone tries to put forward their best foot, right, so that they can, you know, get their foot in the door, so forth. But listen, I'm not beholden to anyone. I ran my campaign. I accepted no donations. I make my decisions based on the merits of each situation. And I'll say this, many people have approached me about lands that are closer to the city of Hamilton. No one has approached me about White Church lands.
That is Mark Tattison. He is the councillor for Ward 11 in Glenbrook. Really appreciate you taking a few minutes today. Thanks.
Hey, thanks, Scott. Okay, bye-bye now.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
This is a bit of a continuation of a discussion we've had a few times on the show. If you're a regular listener, we've talked about AI and deep fakes and those kind of things. Well, some government officials in the States got together to run an experiment to see what would happen if, in a controlled setting, if they set out some deep fakes. And this is related to an election. This is not just someone, you know, I mean, there's other issues with people making fake celebrity porn and all kinds of things, but this is election related. And what they did was they did two different things. One, to a group of elderly people who were in a test group, these people got phone calls with an official sounding voice telling them that the local polling places were closed due to threats from local militia groups on election day. And in another place, there were a bunch of photos and videos that were from social media showing poll workers dumping ballots, cheating basically. Now, these were both created by artificial intelligence. They were not real. But this simulation in the States shocked the people who were doing it, because what they discovered was how quickly people believe this and how easily. Quote, it was jarring to see how quickly just a handful of these types of threats could spiral out of control and really dominate the election cycle, said one of the former senior Department of Homeland Security officials who helped do this. This is something that we are probably almost certainly going to be facing. I want to bring in Carmi Levy. He's a technology analyst. He's a journalist. Joins us now. Carmi, how are you today?
I am great, Scott. Wonderful to be with you.
You as well. And we have talked, we've sort of touched on this before when talking about deepfake and AI and stuff, but here's a real life, almost a real life example. It's a simulation, but it's as real life as you're going to get until something happens. And I think it's pretty darn clear that it would take one compelling deepfake of a federal candidate here on the south side of the border, or a provincial candidate or a municipal candidate saying, not them saying it, but an AI or deepfake saying something outrageous or doing, this could change an entire election.
It absolutely could. Think about the kinds of content that we as voters consume when we decide who we're going to vote for as the clock ticks down to election day. Think of the things that we are absorbing, you know, via various electronic channels. And think about how sometimes we'll just see one video or hear one audio clip and we're like, oh, that seals my vote. Well, what if all of that content is not real? What if someone releases a strategic deepfake at just the right moment to swing the vote their way? It's terrifying. And I think what scared me most about this exercise is how quickly that misinformation can spread because of a few well-placed deepfakes, but also just how close to reality it is. As they were doing this particular exercise, it was from a nonprofit organization in Washington called the Future U.S. As they were doing it, it happened right around the same time as the lead up to the New Hampshire primary, where that deepfake audio of President Biden saying voters should not go out to vote, they needed them to save their vote until November. That was an obvious deepfake. It actually happens in real life. And as we know, it was debunked, but presumably some people heard that before, and that may have changed their decision. So this is like a case of a almost like a war game imitating life, because it's actually happening in an actual election in the U.S., and there's nothing we can do to stop it. And then you kind of add sort of the layer on, because as I was reading further into this report, I realized they had a bunch of retired elected officials, retired civil servants, individuals from technology companies, the kinds of people who would normally be in a war room to handle this kind of thing. And what they showed was that nobody really knew who was in charge. We'd never really done this before. So there were no protocols in place to handle a deep fake going out in one jurisdiction and then another going out in another, and no one could make the decision about who to call, what orders to give, how they were going to shut this down. And so I honestly, when I think of the things that keep me up at night, this is one of them, because it is ridiculously easy to prosecute, as this exercise shows. And unfortunately, the real world experiences that we're seeing, it's already happening out there.
You mentioned how quickly it can happen. There's another part of this. It's not just how quickly it happens, it's how deeply it sets in. And I mean, one of the examples is not a deep fake, but on the weekend, there was a speech that Donald Trump gave where he was talking about the economy, the car manufacturing industry, and talked about how if he's not elected, it's going to be a bloodbath. Every Democrat seemingly immediately decided he meant there's going to be a riot and a, you know, an uprising. Every Republican immediately said, no, he's talking about the economy, obviously. But it took seconds for everyone to coalesce, and everyone decided what they knew that he was saying. Mm-hmm. Now, so you've clearly got people who are eager to believe or disbelieve. But if you're someone who is wanting to believe that Joe Biden is a doddering idiot or that Donald Trump is a racist maniac, and you now get an AI, a deepfake that bolsters that, you will absolutely believe it, I think this shows.
You absolutely will. And what's scary here is that then even when the context is explained, even when the truth comes out, by then it's already too late, because people's minds have already been made
up.
There's no way to correct an untruth, because once it's out there, there's no delete button on the internet. And certainly that applies to deepfakes as well as as in this case, content that was distributed without proper context. And so we also have a highly polarized electorate that doesn't really want to read deeply. They want to see the headlines. They want the short clip. They want sort of be fed a narrative that aligns with their worldview. And let's face it, a well-placed deepfake can play really nicely into that strategy if you're into that kind of thing. And it's pretty clear that it doesn't matter where you are on the political spectrum, that is a tool, a nuclear level tool that is already being used in fairly broad scenarios.
So how in the world does any government or country deal with this? Because to your point, which I think is a very good point, you may have a plan for what you might do, but by the time you could implement that, the damage would already be deeply set and done.
Well, I think part of it involves the platforms themselves. If you look at the reason this is such a problem is that it's bad enough that the deepfakes are being created, but what's worse is once they hit social media, they spread like wildfire. And why? Because the social media platforms allow it. They pour fuel on that fire, and there is no protection in place to slow it down, to identify the content, label it, and then once it's identified as a deepfake, to stop it from spreading. And so I think the technology companies have a role to play here. Certainly, legislation here in Canada, Bill C. 27, the Artificial Intelligence Data Act, could play a role, but it's not a law yet. It's still working its way through the House of Commons. The European Union has, of course, the AI Act that they just activated. That could be a guide for us too. But A, we need a better legislative framework, and then we need better involvement of all of our stakeholders, particularly those tech companies. And then I think, frankly, we need our electoral officials. So who's running the machinery of an election? They've got to war game this, and they've got to make sure that in the control centers where they run an election, that they play out these scenarios. This is one example where they kind of didn't respond very well. Well, keep doing it until you improve your game, until you're able to respond to the way the threat landscape looks today, because clearly they're not prepared. This is all net new to them. They've got to practice and practice and practice to the point that they are able to at least have a conversation, understand what deepfakes, what risks they pose to an election.
Carmi, we got 1 minute, but they could pass all the laws in the world they want, but one of the things we've talked about in Canada for the last year, basically, has been foreign interference. We're struggling with how to investigate this. We don't agree party to party on how we should do this, but there's no question there has been foreign interference. So you can put every law you want on the books to say we will prosecute Canadians who do this kind of thing, but if it comes from offshore, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot you can do.
It doesn't. And there's no way that you can target the Chinese operatives or the Russian operatives or the North Korean or Iranian operatives. And it usually comes from one of those four countries. But what you can do is you can compel the technology companies to implement better standards, to toughen their protections against this, to rehire the content moderators that they have gotten rid of over the last year and a half in the interest of cost efficiency, to open up their algorithms so that they work together to identify deepfake content and remove it automatically before it becomes problematic, to reduce the incidence of false positives. All of these things need to happen. And right now, no one is telling the platforms themselves, you've got to come up with a way to slow this down. I firmly believe the technology is contributing to this problem, at least to start in this election year in the U.S., potentially next in Canada. If we have better technology protections in place, that will go a long way to at least giving electoral officials time to deal with a crisis as it unfolds. Right now, the fire is simply going to spread too quickly.
Yeah, and one of the people who was running this war game test in the States says, as a quote, "That's something we think we're going to see in this election cycle." they're preparing for it. The problem is they don't know what to do yet, and even who should speak to it. And we do have to run. But imagine for a second if it's the White House that has to say that a deepfake of Donald Trump is not real. Do you think they do? Or do you think they take their time until it's set in, or vice versa this seems like it's just destined to be a massive problem soon. Let's hope that's not the case, though. Carmi Levy, always love having you on. Thanks for doing this.
Appreciate being here, Scott. Thanks for having me.
It is a fascinating, terrifying but fascinating situation that I'm absolutely convinced is going to affect elections, whether ours or others. I'm convinced that that is going to be the case.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Let's get into the electric vehicle discussion for a second while you are calling in on that one, because this study out of the University of British Columbia that is just recently out was looking at whether or not you could break even or do better if you buy an electric vehicle, which presumably is what's going to convince a lot of people that they want to buy an electric vehicle. I'm going to not have to spend on gas, and over a certain period of time, that will, you know, the car is more expensive perhaps to begin with, but not paying gas or paying far less gas, eventually those two lines intersect and I'm going to start saving money. Can you really save money? Well, it depends. Researchers found certain provinces are more expensive. For example, you would need to drive 64 kilometers. Now, they use 7 years, by the way, as the model here that you would own the car. I guess that's what they're saying. A lot of people would own their car for 7 years. So over 7 years, you would have to drive your car 64 kilometers a day, every day, over those 7 years to break even in British Columbia. However, in Ontario, you would have to drive 88 kilometers every single day for 7 years on average, or else you're not going to be breaking even. It's going to be costing you money. Is this something that is going to matter? Are people going to look at this kind of thing? Is this going to make a difference? Let's bring in Brian Kingston. He's president of the Canadian Vehicle Manufacturers Association. Brian, how are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Listen, I'm thrilled to have you on because it's such an important topic, because we've seen, as I said a moment ago, the federal government is spending billions of dollars in grants to build these electric vehicle battery manufacturing plants. Clearly, the intent is that someday we're all going to have one of these. But I don't know if people are going to buy these if it doesn't save them money. What do you think?
No, that's exactly it. And the government's gone further. They've actually introduced a regulation that will require every Canadian to purchase an EV within the next 11 years. And so, you know, we've been raising these concerns around the price gap primarily, because we know that consumers will only make the switch if they see this as an economical choice. And right now, this technology is more expensive. It's about $14,000 more expensive on average for an EV. And so we have to close that gap if we think we're going to get every Canadian to switch to an electric vehicle.
I mean, we'll get into a bunch of different things, but the other thing that pops to mind immediately is we've seen a number of stories recently about people who have an EV being kind of shocked when they go to get repairs done or change the battery. So in that time, this study, I don't think, has even factored in things like repairs and replacements and things like that, which could also add to the price.
Yeah, well, look, let's start with the good news here, which is that the price point is going to come down over time because automakers are investing approximately $1.2 trillion globally into this technology. So as production ramps up, economies of scale kick in, you will see that price gap close. On the maintenance side, EV maintenance is lower than a gas-powered vehicle because you're not doing the oil changes and they don't need as many repairs. Battery life is getting longer and longer. 15 to 20 years is becoming quite common. So these are all going to be very positive factors for EV adoption. But in these early years, if we're going to help people switch, we have to give them incentives to do so because they simply won't make the switch if they can't afford it.
Do you think that, and you've alluded to it a second ago, but do you think that finances are going to be the driving concern? I don't want to do the bad unintentional pun, but is it going to be purely a financial decision, or is there going to just be a large segment of the population that's really concerned about being green and really concerned about the environment, says, I don't care what it costs, I want to do this?
That is a very small segment of the population that will make the switch purely for environmental reasons. We see really two issues that come up when consumers are considering an EV. First is, can I charge it? Is there enough charging infrastructure? Can I plug in at home? Once you get past that, the next question is, can I afford it? And that's where things like incentives that we see in place in provinces like Quebec and British Columbia make a big difference, because it helps to address that price gap that is currently in place. But if we can overcome those two barriers, this is a great technology and you're going to have mass adoption quite quickly. But we have not done enough to address charging and affordability.
All right, let's go to charging, because I think those two words, charging and affordability, affordability is an individual thing, but it's also a communal thing, because it's going to take an awful lot of tax dollars to create enough charging stations all on all the highways and all the places and all everywhere. Is it not? I mean, we're not, I keep hearing that we're not remotely close to being ready for what they want us to be doing.
No, we're not. We're not close. And we've put out something called the Road to 2035, which effectively looks at what needs to happen between now and 2035 if this government target is going to be reached. And on charging, the federal government's estimated that we need about 442,000 public chargers built in the next 11 years. Right now, today, there are 27,000 operational. So just to give you a sense of what it's going to take to close that gap, we need about 100 chargers to be built every single day for the next 11 years. And that will cost money and will take a huge effort to do it. And I'm just not seeing the pace of construction that's going to get us to that target that has been established. And if the charging's not there, people won't make the switch.
Well, so that's going to be, I would imagine those are reasonably cost. I have no idea what a charging station costs. You know what each one of them would cost roughly? You have any idea?
The estimate for that build out is about $20 billion.
Oh, sorry, I just swallowed my tongue. Okay. So, all right, that's an extraordinary amount of money. And then the other side of this thing is that we, as you say, the speed to get this done, we also, and I don't know if this is correct, but I keep hearing this, is we don't have the electric capability. Forget the stations, that in order to, if every gas-powered vehicle or almost all of them were in time to switch over, we don't have the capacity electrically to do this, do we?
We do not, as it stands right now. And if you look at the most recent estimates, we're talking about an increase of anywhere from 5 to 15% of our current annual generation to meet the demands of electric vehicles. Now, the good news on that is that a lot of EVs are going to have what's called bi-directional charging, which means they can feed back into the grid. So as the technology develops, and most EVs will charge overnight, they will require less energy at peak times and can actually provide electricity back into the system when necessary. I think the bigger challenge is going to be the actual transmission capacity. Think about a charging station and how much electricity it's going to draw. It will need to have lines to that station, transformers, and that will take time to build, and it's costly to build. And that's ultimately what's concerning us, is that the government set this very, very rigid target, and all of these elements have to come into place in a very short period of time if this is going to be achieved.
Look, I don't want to get into a whole political discussion about this, but it does seem, based on what you're talking about and what we've all been reading, that these are very ambitious targets. And if you're going to put these in place, maybe it's a wiser thing to say, rather than spreading our money and our attention on 5,000 different things across the country, programs, let's focus on this and really make this happen. And if you do that, maybe it can work. I say, with what I'm hearing, it just seems like someday this may be okay, but it doesn't sound like we're anywhere remotely close to being able to do it within the targets they're setting.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that the government has put the cart before the horse on this one with this regulation. The industry is moving in this direction. Every day you'll see a new announcement about an EV model coming to market. So this is happening without a government regulation in place. What we're asking for is work with us on building out the preconditions so that this technology is appealing and feasible to Canadians. Don't dictate what vehicles Canadians can and can't buy. That will not work. So I think they've got the sequencing wrong here. If you actually work on trying to address these market conditions, you'll see people switch, but don't mandate them to do so.
There's another thing that in the story that was talking about this that I'm reading that it points to, and it never dawned on me, and I'm not entirely sure why this would be the case, but they're saying that insurance is also going to factor into this, because EV owners are going to see their insurance rates rise in the coming years. Why would insurance rates go up for electric vehicles? I'm not sure I understand.
Yeah, I think the issue that you're seeing right now is because EVs are still a relatively small proportion of the overall market, you're seeing a premium on some of those insurance rates. And as the industry transitions, there's going to be some time with respect to training on repairing batteries and repairing this new, very advanced technology. I don't think over time that that will be the case. Once you get to a point where you've got 5, 6, 7 million electric vehicles on the road, you're going to have very competitive offerings in the insurance space for EV drivers. But we are in that still very much an early adopter phase. And as a result, you're seeing some of those higher costs on EV drivers.
And is it still a bit of an unknown? Because these haven't been around all that. I mean, it's tests and some, but they really haven't been around in a grand scale for all that long. So insurance companies are waiting to see how this plays.
I think that that could be part of it. And the technology is, it's advancing extremely rapidly. I mean, if you think back to just 10 years ago, we had three EVs in the Canadian market. Today, there's over 80. And the range has gone from, the early days, an EV was basically a small car and you're lucky to get 80 kilometers of range. Now we're looking at things like an F-150 Lightning that can deliver 500 or 600 kilometers of range. And that is getting better year after year. So the technology is absolutely still developing. And I think you could see a scenario where vehicles will be able to travel 800, 900, sometimes 1,000 kilometers on a single charge. So it is very much in development and it's getting better and better.
There is, though, the common refrain. We've talked a lot of common refrains, but the common refrain that really excessively cold weather is not great for these still, for any battery. And there are parts of this country where that's still a reality. We had a very mild winter this year, but northern Alberta, northern Saskatchewan, up in the Northwest Territories, all those places, it is a new challenge that they aren't necessarily going to have the same range. Has that problem been solved?
Not yet, not yet. And a lot of investment is obviously going into that, and companies are always working on cold weather testing. You're absolutely right. Cold weather has an impact on battery life. We see that sometimes, 20, 30% of range loss is possible in extreme cold weather. That said, I don't think that that is going to be a huge barrier for the majority of Canadians because the technology is getting better and better. If you live in an extremely far north community where minus 40 is regular throughout the winter, yeah, there could be feasibility challenges there for some time to come. But for the majority of Canadians, the cold weather operation issue will be resolved very soon.
Let me throw one more thing out to you, which I think is an issue in urban centers, a lot of different places. We, for example, here in Hamilton, our city council, like a lot of other places, is really pushing to improve density in downtowns. We want more people living in the downtown, more in buildings, not so much in the sprawl. We don't want to build all these homes out in the suburbs and everything else. However, if you are someone who's now moving into a place that in some cases they don't have as much parking, or it's you have to park on the street, you realize that if I buy one of these things, it's not really easy to find a way to, if I have to park on the street, how do I even plug this thing in? Like there are some conflicting moves being made here. More density, but that makes it way harder for people. They don't have the space, the driveway necessarily, or even the parking spot to charge it. There's conflicting things here that are going to make it difficult.
Yes, absolutely. And this is why, particularly in dense urban areas, we need to see a far more thoughtful approach on both on-street charging and public charging facilities that will help Canadians that live in those areas make the switch to an electric. So just look at a city like Montreal. They've done a lot of good work on this. Vancouver is in the same situation. The municipalities have installed a lot of on-street charging in areas where people have effectively parking passes, parking permits, and they park their vehicle on street overnight. You're going to have chargers at all of those locations if those folks are going to be able to switch to an electric. On top of that, we need to see in dense urban areas parkades where you can go and charge your vehicle with a fast charger so that people that don't have the luxury of a driveway or a parking spot can get their vehicle charged. Because if you don't have that option and it's inconvenient to switch, I'm worried a lot of people just won't switch. That's the rational decision.
Oh, and I agree with you. I mean, we have, for example, and again, I don't expect you to know this because you may not be as familiar, but there are some streets now in downtown Hamilton where the parking is not even on the curb. There's a bike lane between the car park and then the sidewalk and the home. If you have an electric vehicle, I'm not entirely sure how you charge your car there right now. These things become challenges that have to be sorted out. You can't just say, deal with it. No, these are real things that you have to resolve.
Exactly. And this is why, you know, back to my earlier point on the government regulating this switch, we want Canadians to make the switch to this technology because it's a better technology, it's more convenient for them, and it will save them money over time. But for those factors to fall into place, you have to address the issues that we've discussed. If you tell somebody you must switch to an electric vehicle, oh, and by the way, we're not providing on-street charging and there's no parking in your neighborhood, and we're not going to provide a purchase incentive, so the cost will be higher. That's a very tough sell. And that's what concerns me about the regulatory approach that's being taken.
That is Brian Kingston. He is president of the Canadian Vehicle Manufacturers Association. Great chat, Brian. Really appreciate you doing this.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you. This is an idea. Look, I think there's a lot of people who love the idea of electric vehicles. I do. I think they think that this is something that, you know, a wave of the future and green and all the rest. But Brian is 100% correct. I believe he's 100% correct that if you don't provide the ways for people to use these things, to charge these things, to have access to these things, they're going to say no. And similarly, if the cost remains exorbitant, which in some cases they are, and if financially it doesn't look like you're ever going to save any money, I think it remains a huge challenge, especially if, as he says, the government is mandating. Now, I want to just correct something that he said at the very beginning. I know what he was trying to say, but in case the government has not said you must buy, it's not mandating that you buy a vehicle. And I know what he was getting at, but it's if you want to buy a car, it's got to be an electric vehicle eventually. I don't think the government has yet said everyone must buy an electric vehicle. That would be an interesting position to take. Car manufacturers would love that. I'm not sure that everyone else would, but anyway, there's a lot of work to be done before this mandate comes into effect. And yet, I don't know if where you are, you're seeing all this work being done, but I'm not. I don't know if magically the giant electric vehicle fairy is going to sweep over the land and wave her wand, and all of a sudden there's going to be the 442,000 charging stations that he says we need all of a sudden overnight. But if there's not, then we better get started on this, no? Otherwise, we're just beating our head against the wall and dreaming in Technicolor that eventually this is all just going to come together. It doesn't just happen by accident.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.